Welcome to another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. My guest on today's podcast is my friend Brian Mortensen. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
Will you introduce yourself to our listeners?
My name is Brian Mortensen. I live in Woods Cross, Utah. Been married to my wife for about 5.5 years. We're expecting twins coming along here in a couple months. And I work as a UX designer down in Draper at a place called Progressive Leasing.
That's great. And congratulations on the twins.
Thank you.
Brian and I offered a prayer before we started this podcast, as we want to be able to share things that are complicated in a faithful way for our listeners. We hope the Spirit will be here, and we're excited to have Brian here. Brian's story is, he wants to share, and I'm glad we can share it. His story is a Mormon missionary. Going to the MCC, coming home because of emotional challenges. I don't know if that's the right term to describe it, Brian, and then being able to go back out. And I thought it would be great to have Brian share his story. So many of our missionaries faithfully want to serve missions. Some aren't because of these kind of challenges. Some serve and come home. But I think Brian's story just helps us understand more of the wonderful men and women that are navigating this road in our restored church. So, Brian, tell us about your journey here.
Yeah, I went into the MTC about 3 months after graduation from high school, and kind of had always planned on a mission. Was one of the first to get my calls in my class. I was going to go to the Phoenix, Arizona mission. Very excited. Got to the MTC, and about 3 days in, 4 days in, I thought I had had a heart attack. It was a physical sensation. In my mind at the time, was very much a physical breakdown. I thought I needed to go to the hospital. Eventually, it happened the day after and the day after that, about the same time, around like 5 o'clock at the night. I was being told at that point that you're fine physically. This is a panic attack. And I'd always assumed panic attacks were when you were aware of the panic you were feeling, that some sort of stressor makes you panicked because a fear of flying, a fear, you know, those easy ones. I didn't realize that it could happen subconsciously, something that I wasn't even aware of that was wrong. On the fifth day, as my parents were coming down to try to, you know, help me, they made the decision that it was important that I figure this out before I went out on my mission, and I was sent home. And I thought at the time that would be okay, so these panic attacks will now stop. And I was a little bit relieved of like, okay, I am sad I'm being sent home, but at least this will go away. But the problem was that once I got home, it just kept happening.
And walk us back to your high school. Were you having panic attacks? Was this part of a feeling that you'd had before? Or was this completely new territory for you?
I had never experienced a panic attack before. Looking back with hindsight, we probably could have looked at some warning signs that I had had, you know, a fear of storms and a dislike of being in a place for too long. If I was, even church, sometimes I'd just get antsy at the end of church. And looking back now, realizing that I had a lot of autonomy in high school, I was the first to get my driver's license, and I just was able to do the things that I wanted to do. And I always followed the rules, but I always knew, okay, if I wanted to go somewhere or leave or to get where I needed to go, that was just going to happen. And I think in retrospect, I had never experienced that lack of autonomy in my life. And the MTC was the first place where it was truly, it's not really up to me what my schedule is, what I need to do. So definitely some warning signs that in retrospect, we could have maybe seen coming, but I never experienced it or talked about it with anyone.
So your parents came from Bountiful to the Provo MTC to pick you up. Mm-hmm. And you had been to the MTC how long when this happened?
5 days.
5 days. Mm-hmm. And so they had just dropped you off 5 days ago
with
all these expectations of not seeing you for 2 years and you serving this mission. 5 days later, they're there picking up. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about how you felt at that point and driving back to Bountiful.
It's hard to see your parents with the lack of answers for you. I think especially my mom, was just so caught off guard about what she needed to be doing. Uh-huh. And my dad, I think, was actually pretty angry that what was happening, not with me, but with the church, uh-huh. Which was also stressful because you don't want to be a reason that your parents are mad at the church.
Interesting.
But I think that's when it started hitting me that, oh, this feeling's not going to go away, because it's just as bad at home as it was there. So it changed a lot of things in my life. It was very earth shattering to me that basically everything in my life changed within a week about assumptions I had. You know, I thought that I was going to be, you know, the best missionary that ever had been, kind of the typical, you know, green fire. I was really excited about a mission, and then all of a sudden it was kind of turned on its head. So
wow. And I think, just so our listeners understand, both Brian and I are active members of the church, so obviously Brian's been able to stay active. We'll talk about him going back on his mission, but this didn't cause Brian to leave the church. Mm-mm. And so I admire you kind of navigating that. I've never thought of this, but you use the words that are correct. I was sent home. Do you think that's the right term to use? I've wondered, is there a better word to use when someone leaves the MTC and comes home?
Well,
sent home sounds like high school. It sounds like being sent to the principal office. It's a negative connotation. It's reality.
Yeah. I mean, and this is, and we'll probably get more to this, but, I think there's this understanding that everyone that gets sent home or comes home early has a similar understanding of how that happens. For me, it really was not a choice that I made. They did not ask me, do you need to go? It was, hey, just from what we've seen, you have to go home. And so sent home for me was an actual, I was sent home. I know a lot of other missionaries, because of course, when you come home early, that community of people is very supportive of each other. And so a lot of other people who had decided to come home, had asked to come home, they would probably not like the term sent home, because to them that was more of a decision. For me and for other missionaries who struggle with mental health, a lot of times it's not a choice. It is something that is sent home. Now, divorcing that from the stigma of the term sent home, that can kind of be a scarlet letter. You were sent home, and I do think that exists for anyone who comes home early, that you're, you know, quote unquote sent home, and that carries a lot of stigma of, and I've enjoyed the last couple of years, the change in language, from an early return, because that still communicates some of the situation without a lot of the judgment of you were sent home. So
take us through the next 6 months, because you're home for 6 months and you're trying to get healthy enough to go back on a mission.
Yeah. The church, the missionary medical department made it pretty clear that what I needed to do was have about 6 months of being on medication, because that's about as long as it takes for the antidepressants to start really taking effect. So I knew that I had 6 months where I was not going to be able to go back out, but that I needed to kind of stabilize. So what I wanted to do was maybe, you know, being young and thinking that I needed to definitely be taking care of all the check marks, I said, okay, I have my deferment to BYU. I'll just go down to BYU as soon as I can. So during that 6 months, I went back down to BYU, which was another kind of gut punch, because I have always been a huge BYU fan. I was so excited to go to BYU, and I got there, and it was incredibly difficult to be an early return missionary at BYU at the time. Because most of the kids who are, you know, endowed at BYU are usually return missionaries. But so I was endowed.
Interesting.
And there was an outward marker, of course. The garment thing is something that people look for. And so a lot of questions about, like, oh, where did you serve your mission? And at first I would try to explain it. And then later I realized, oh, trying to tell anyone the subtleties of what was going on just caused me a lot of internal strife. So I actually started having more symptoms of anxiety and, you know, was working with the psychiatrist, and they started prescribing like benzos, which are just sedatives, as well as like sleeping medication. And at the time I thought, okay, whatever I need to do to get get back out. So I'm going to do, but then at the end of that 6 months, kind of went back to the missionary medical department and said, okay, I want to get back out. I thought the only way I was ever going to feel better is if I got back out on a mission. And they told me, oh, well, you can't be on benzos or, sleeping medication, while you're in the field. And we need at least 6 months of you not being on those before you can go back out. So I was going to have to do another 6 months at home. And that just seemed impossible.
Did you know that, when you first started those drugs?
I didn't. And yeah, that was
a curveball.
Yeah. And to be fair, I don't know that missionary medical at this point had really figured out the extent of this issue, which I think nowadays they're a little bit more of a predefined path of what you're supposed to be doing. I just didn't have the kind of that benefit of knowing exactly what was next for me.
You're doing a great job of sharing your story. You're really vulnerable and courageous, Brian, to just talk about this and talk about being on medication. Sometimes in our culture, that's even seen as weak.
Yeah.
To be on medication, and that we as men should be able to just sort of tough it out. And we don't do that kind of stuff. And I think you're helping us all understand that we need to see a psychiatrist at times, and we need people with expertise in mental health area to understand what's going on. And we need to take appropriate prescriptions. So thank you. Go back to this. I'm interested in your time at BYU. Let's say there's listeners that are aware there's an early release missionary in their ward or in their area. What would be some of the helpful things that people would say?
I guess the most helpful was when it actually didn't really become a big issue. It was when people were like, and a lot of times it was people who like chose not to serve missions at BYU. They were kind of like, oh yeah, okay. And it was like, oh, I'm like a normal person and being treated like a normal person. And again, in retrospect, it might've been unfair to me to expect to go to BYU and have it that not become a topic of conversation, but both severe judgments about why I would come home, and also severe sympathy were equally as hurtful to me. And it was hard because when someone's being sympathetic towards you, you want to really be appreciative of that. But it stung and it made me feel less than. And
talk about that severe sympathy. Talk about that.
Well, because especially when you want to be a missionary, and then when people act so sympathetic, it starts to make you feel defective. You know, and like, yeah, something must be wrong with me because these people feel really bad for me. So something must be off with who I am. And that's, of course, not their intention at all. And that's why it's really even hard to describe to someone why I was having such a hard time. Because when someone's expressing sympathy, you don't want to come back at them and say, why are you treating me like I'm less than? Because, of course, in their mind, they're just trying to show love. And so a lot of times it was just kind of shutting down and just not talking about that. And I really understand why a lot of people who do come home don't want to talk about it at all, because it's like there's nothing people can even say to make you feel not somehow defective or alien or unrighteous, you know. And a lot of times people would say, you know, you'll figure it out, you'll get back out. And I would say, yeah, that's I think what I want. But what if I don't? What if I don't figure this out? And so it a lot of complex emotions. And the times I was most appreciative is when it was support with, and it's a lot of what your podcast is. They would listen to what I had to say. They would ask, you know, like, well, you know, how do you want people to treat you? And I would usually just say, just pretend like I hadn't gone and I was about, you know, I'm a year away from even putting my papers in. And maybe then I would feel like, oh, I'm the same as everyone else, you know, just working towards trying to get out on a mission.
I like that answer. Sometimes, and I don't know the answer to this question, people tell me there's a difference between sympathy and empathy. Any thoughts on that, Brian?
Yeah, I think sympathy is trying to be sad with you, and that sounds even a little intense, but it's because like in our baptismal covenant, you know, we promise to mourn with those who mourn. And coming home from a mission, I think a lot of people assume that you're mourning. And in a way you are, but in another way, it's like, this is not something that should define who I am, that I had to come home early. Empathy is trying to put yourself in someone's shoes and figure out how they would react to being told certain things. So
that's cool.
Putting yourself in my shoes, having a lot of sympathy actually can make you feel even, you know, more hurt than if someone says, you know, why, you know, you came home, something must be wrong with you. Because when people say something must be wrong with you, I know that's not true. I know that it has nothing to do with my faith. So it's really easy to go, oh, shrug that off. But when people are overly sympathetic, it starts feeling like, oh, I'm being treated as if I am not worthy of this, or that they're mourning a death of my, you know, potential. And again, I don't mean to say that with any sort of judgment. Most of what I experienced, I think, was a lack of people even having experience with this happening. You know, in the 10 years since I had this experience, I've seen the membership of the church make tremendous growth about how having better conversations about it. And that only just comes from being exposed to more and more people who had this experience.
Tell me about... it sounds like people that made the conversation about when you're going to go back out, mm-hmm. those were harder conversations than the people that just wanted to get to know you, Brian.
Yeah.
And what you were studying and what your interests were and what your hopes were, and just got to know you as a person versus you as when are you going back out. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, a lot of times on your podcast, you'll talk about just listening without prescriptive advice or bearing testimony. And when someone would come and be like, well, what's your plan? And a lot of times I would just kind of have to throw back as like, listen, I'm ready and willing to go as soon as the church will let me. And sometimes that would kind of let them know like, oh, he's on the right path. But sometimes it would be like, no, here's what you got to do here. You know, you just, if you, you know, if you know, a lot of people would turn it to a faith thing and say, if you pray or you study enough, the Spirit will carry you through this.
Wow.
And I don't necessarily want to be judgmental of them saying that, because there are times in your life when turning to the scriptures or prayer can help you overcome an obstacle. But it was very counterproductive in my situation, because I was like, I was there. I was not, I did not have a lack of faith or a lack of willingness to serve. This is something that I don't even feel like has anything to do with that. And then a lot of people would start telling me things like the statistics on how many people come home who go inactive, which I don't doubt are true. But they would say, you know, it's really hard to remain active if you don't go back out. And I'm like, yeah, I can kind of see why, because you start not feeling a part of the community anymore. It becomes, people don't know where to put you. They don't know what box in their mind to say, well, this person is righteous but not a mission. How does that make sense?
That's very helpful. I'm thinking what you just earlier said about noticing your garments, and that led to a question about where did you serve.
Yeah.
And it's probably good that we don't look for people garment lines to see if they're there or not. I've tried not to do that as a way of measuring if someone's Mormon or not, mm-hmm. or how Mormon they are. And to me, that's a covenant between them and God. And I could see where that, you know, the fact they noticed your garments then created a very uncomfortable conversation, even though there was no intent to do that. And maybe we can, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought a lot about this, because I found that dating or the possibility of dating after coming home was not on the table for me, because I had been endowed and girls at BYU who are looking for a return missionary would strike up conversation and then find out that I didn't serve a mission. And in their mind, they'd always been told, you need to marry a return missionary. You need to marry a return missionary. And I always thought that was a great standard. You know, I was like, yeah, of course. You want to encourage these young men to go serve missions. And then I started realizing that, wow, that's a false indicator of intent. That's a false indicator of spiritual growth. And one of the things that an answer to my prayers was when the missionary age change happened and so many more of our sisters got the opportunity to choose to go serve missions, that this sort of stigma of you need to marry a return missionary, well, a lot of these girls understand the reality of mission hardship and the reality of people struggling with the mission. And it's becoming less and less of I need to marry a return missionary and more and more of, oh, I just need to get to know who this person is and That's see if cool. they are spiritually compatible. So that sort of, and especially at BYU where everyone is looking to date for marriage, it was so alienating to realize, oh, this person will be interested in me until they realize I didn't serve a mission. And then it kind of tails off. And again, I don't know if I can fault them, because I understand what they were thinking, but it was hurtful. It definitely hurt
Thanks for sharing that. And you could see why some people then out of their emotional health might choose to distance themselves because it's just painful.
Yeah.
And so I think that's helpful for our members. You mentioned before we started on this podcast your love for your parents, and I'm thinking of my own situation with my sons. And if I were coming back to the MTC 5 days later to pick up my son, I probably would not be prepared for that. And I assume your parents did some things that were great and some things that were not great.
Yeah.
As they were trying to love you and navigate this road, talk about some of the things they did that were very helpful, especially for parents that are, you know, have an early return missionary or trying to prepare for this possibility in their own family.
I think the first couple of months were incredibly difficult for them. And even for my sisters, I have four little sisters, and I don't know that they knew how to react either. They didn't know what to say. And I think the earliest point at which I was like, this is the kind of thing I need, is my dad sat me down about midway through that 6 months, about 3 months in, and I was really struggling. And he said, whatever you choose to do, you're going to be successful. And just realizing that he had confidence in me as a person, regardless of outcome, it made all the world of a difference for me. And then my decisions later about what I needed to do to take next steps, I had more confidence that it was coming out of what I was spiritually led to do and not just out of a prescriptive, I need to follow what my parents say or what the church says or what missionary medical says, but follow my own kind of personal revelation. So both my parents, you know, struggled a lot with it. It was a big problem in our family. Not that they were ever hurtful. It was a kind of a wound. But they really rallied behind me, and that would mean all the world.
I love that line. I have confidence in you without outcome. Is that what you said?
Yeah. That's
a beautiful line.
Yeah. He was basically saying that a lot of times the people who, and I think he was, again, just trying to inspire some confidence in me. And I think they had gone to a concert, and he thought a lot about musicians who a lot of their early lives were hard, and they had stuff that really defined a struggle for them. And they went on to find success because of the struggle. And he said, whether you go back out, whether you don't, I know that you are going to be successful. That really freed me up to go, okay, now I just have to figure out what I need to do. And that was, I think, the kind of the turning point for me of like, okay, I am capable enough of a person to try to overcome this obstacle in my life. So,
and it sounds like he's separated his love for you from any sort of outcome.
Yeah, absolutely.
And any sort of, you know, going back on your mission or not, or any sort of outcome. And that's really powerful.
It was.
Talk about the family lessons for good that this has created. I'm assuming that your whole family is different because of this experience, and there's added beauty and gifts that are part of your family because of this. Any thoughts on that, Brian?
Yeah, I think what it did in both my nuclear family and in my extended family is it started to give people permission to struggle. And then, especially at later when I had really recovered from a lot of this, when anybody else in my family started struggling with anything big, it was easier for us to just be supportive. Because it taught us that, like, even if you do not have the exact outcome that you want or that things are going wrong, that if you just support each other, that eventually goes away. That the trials of life don't define us. It's that love that does. And, you know, our family has had a lot of challenges since then, that at least in my opinion has been easier to deal with because of having to come together through that experience.
That's beautiful. That's really cool. It's a credit to you. It's a credit to your parents and your family. So walk us through getting back on your mission.
Yeah. So as soon as the missionary medical told me it was going to be 6 more months before I could go back out, I went to my parents and I said, I can't do that. I either need to transfer from BYU. But I was very worried that if I transferred from BYU, it would be hard for me to remain active, not hard for me to be, have a testimony, but hard for me to just be going to church because of how hurt I felt. Mm-hmm. And, my parents were involved in the Inn at Palmyra, which is a hotel right next to the historical sites. And actually, kind of really interesting is my grandpa, when they went back out with all of his sons and daughters, he felt very impressed that they needed to build a hotel there. And my parents were very critical of that because they felt, oh, this seems a little bit priestcrafty, you know, like, oh, we need to profit off of these holy sites. Now knowing what happened in my life, I think he was feeling spiritual inspiration for me, because we went out to Palmyra and just went and started talking to the, me and my dad went back to Palmyra and started talking to the mission president there and the historical sites mission president, because there are two different mission presidents, and came up with a plan for me to do a service mission. And it was going to be a 2-year service mission where I would, from 9 to 5, would be working on the historical sites. And then from 6 to 9, I would be with the proselyting missionaries. And so I lived at the hotel, and I had a companion who was he was another service missionary. His story was that he had spent his 20s away from the church, not worthy to serve a mission, and then had come back and said, I want to serve a mission. And he was a woodworker, so they had lots for him to do. So we were, you know, not sleeping in the same place, but from 9 to 5, we were companions and out doing really cool work, a lot of really cool stuff, like, you know, re-roofing the Joseph Smith home.
That's cool.
And really humbling work, like cleaning out the women's restrooms, you know? So for me, it was incredibly therapeutic to be on a mission, but also to be able to do physical labor. For some reason, that just really comforted me, of like, I don't know how much of my life I feel really confident in, but I know I can work and I can go put the work in. And I did that for the whole, you know, spring, summer, and into the fall, and helped with the pageant, did some technical sound stuff for them. So yeah, really, really cool experience, and a credit to the two mission presidents who really made it possible for me to be there. So
that's really good. Did your anxiety come back when you were Palmyra?
It definitely lessened. It was a relief, but every month or so, I would have a little bit of an episode where I would say, when I return back to Utah, when I go back to my life, I don't know if this is going to count in people's minds. I just don't know if they're going to see it as valid. And that would give me that same feeling of being boxed and not knowing. And for a long time, I had been like, you know, after this, I just might not go home. I might just try to live somewhere else besides Utah, so that that sting didn't come back. So there was still some symptoms, but it got a ton better.
That's wow. I'm kind of hung on some of those words, that my experience would not be valued back in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a first class mission or whatever. I don't want to put words in your mind that weren't there, but this feeling that even though I was serving the Lord, and I was on his errand, and I was consecrating my life to the Lord Palmyra, but somehow when I came back to Utah, that would not be seen that way. It would be lesser.
Yeah.
And that brought anxiety, as you're sitting in Palmyra serving God,
mm-hmm.
and serving our church and consecrating your time.
Mm-hmm.
That's really helpful and painful, as we recognize the culture that we have that we're trying to improve, so that, you know, you would not have that anxiety and we would see you as a full equal,
mm-hmm.
and not try to measure different experiences of which are more valid, I think you, or less valid, that they're all valid.
Mm-hmm.
And what a remarkable thing it is that you spent 6 months. How long did you spend out there, Brian?
Almost 6 months of the day.
So walk us through, you ended up in Texas. Talk us through that experience.
Yeah, actually, a former teammate of a sports team I was on, as he was on his mission in Lubbock, Texas, and had basically heard a conference talk that had reminded him of me. And he'd mentioned it to his mission president, and the mission president actually said, well, I think I know that person you're talking about. And the mission president was someone who was in he was a vice principal at my junior high school.
Wow.
And so he called my parents and said, what's Brian up to? He felt prompted to call Wow. them, and they said, oh, he's on a service mission in Palmyra. And he called me and said, I want you to come down and do a proselyting mission. And I was terrified at the prospect because I was like, if I have to go back into a mission and I fail, not fail, and I can't do it again, or there's something that blocks it again, I don't know if that will be emotionally healthy for me. And so I made a decision pretty like within a couple of days that no, I'm not going to do this. But I didn't think that anyone would accept my decision. And so what I decided to do, and this is kind of at the height of my arrogance, was I would go into the sacred grove and I would pray to see if I needed to go back. And then I would just tell them that the answer was no, because I was pretty sure that's what the answer was going to be.
It's pretty honest.
Uh-huh. And so I got out into the sacred grove and I sat down to pray. And I mean, and I hate stories where lots of really random coincidences are evidence of faith. But the minute I knelt down, there was a flash of light. And I was very frightened right away.
Wow.
But it was actually lightning, and it immediately started raining incredibly hard. And and part of my anxiety early in life was, and storms. Looking back, was storms. And so I was like, okay, I guess I got to go back to the mission. So I had gotten spiritual confirmation that I needed to go back. And I flew directly from New York back to Texas. I didn't go home. And I got there and the mission president was like, yep, you're going to be on the mission. And he worked it out so that I didn't have to return to the MTC, which was another big concern.
Wow.
That I'd have to go back. And then, yeah, put me with a trainer right away. And I was on a proselyting mission.
So there's a friend of yours. I just want to, for our listeners, to go through the order. There is a friend that's serving a mission in Texas. Mm-hmm. That's your friend from high school.
Yeah.
And he reads a conference talk?
Yeah, it was Sister Allred's talk about standing up for what you believe in, even when it's hard. Because I was on a football team where a coach was discussing some really inappropriate things. And I eventually had to tell someone. And for the rest of the season, in every drill, no one would block for me, you know. And I just got, I would get pummeled, just pummeled. And it was a really hard time for me. And it was one of the first times where I thought choosing the right didn't actually help me at all.
Yeah.
And so he remembered that when Sister Allred gave that talk and told that.
Was he on the football team?
He was, yeah.
And he respected you for doing that?
Not at the time. Yeah. And again, it's one of those things that I faith promoting language of, oh, it's supposed to happen. But looking back, I have no explanation for how that
so
series of events.
So he went to the mission president. Mm-hmm. And said, I think this guy could be in our mission.
He actually just went to him and said, that makes me feel bad for how we treated this kid on my football team. And then the mission president was like, I think I know who you're talking about. Because he was, you know, my vice principal at the time and knew enough that I was not getting picked on, but that there was some contention among me and the other players. And so then he felt impressed to call my parents. So
he called your parents. Mm-hmm. Who then gave him your number in Palmyra.
Yeah. And he had not known that I had come home. So it's not
and
something he knew.
In that very first conversation, did he invite you to come to Texas? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. It was actually, I think, the third thing he said. He said, hi, how are you doing? Asked me how my service mission was going, and then goes, well, I want you to come down to my mission.
And if he were here on the podcast, why would he have done, what would he say caused him to do that? It's a very unusual thing for a mission president to sort of reach out to a service missionary that he casually knew.
I feel
impressed to invite him to be in your mission.
Yeah, I think his attitude throughout most of his time in education would probably have prepared him for something like this, where he was already attuned to the idea that people on the fringes are sometimes, they go down bad paths because they're not included, you know? And I think the kind of seeing bullying and having to address bullying made him understand how being marginalized like that could put me on a bad path. And so I think I don't think he would necessarily say, I thought to reach out to him on a service mission. And I just think he thought, if he doesn't ever feel included again, we might lose him. And,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you went on a service mission and you had no idea that your next flight would be to Texas.
Nope.
So you fly from, I don't think there's many nonstop flights from Palmyra to Texas. No. Lubbock, I think, is where you ended up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so talk to us about serving in Texas.
The first couple months were pretty hard. And in looking back, I actually think, oh, that was my first normal mission experience, is having a hard first couple months. The really good thing about at that point was there was not a lot of pressure in my mind about expectation. I was there and I was there thinking all I need to do is to try to serve people, in the way that I've been served. 'Cause at that point I just felt so blessed to have other people reach out that I was like, I want to try to find people in Texas that feel that way, that feel a little bit left out of the culture, of their community, of their family, and try to help them feel included. And I felt, and I still feel very strongly that one of the best aspects of our church is community building and making people feel like they belong. And so I just kind of channeled that into it. And I still struggled. The anxiety was there. And it never has really gone away from my life since then. It's something I've learned to really kind of accept about myself, is that, yeah, I struggle with some anxiety that is just going to be part of who I am. But the confidence that didn't have to define who I was as a missionary was pretty instilled in me. So I had a really good trainer who understood kind of what I had been through. My mission president would tell me all the time, we're going to give you a bigger box than other missionaries. That if you are having a hard time, we're going to say, let's step back from some of the rules and allow you to breathe and then let you go back to it. And that just created kind of,
did he use that term?
He did. He said, we're just going to give you a bigger box.
What an interesting visual.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting.
And
we're
one of the,
give you a bigger box and step back from some of the rules.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he would tell me is, part of this also is that I don't want to necessarily tell everyone that you're in a bigger box, because some missionaries need a smaller box and want that smaller box. Because for a while I was really critical of some of the rules. And he finally took me aside and said, you know, there are missionaries that if they were allowed to take a break like you, they would not feel like they were being productive. They would not feel like they're being righteous. And so I with every missionary, I have to listen to the Spirit. And I kind of understood at that point, okay, this is not about me as a missionary versus another missionary. And I think a bigger lesson is, this is not about my membership or my testimony versus someone else's membership and their testimony. This is just about me trying to work through it. And then having him on my side and him understanding that if I was needing a break, it wasn't that I was trying to break the rules, or it wasn't that I was saying I'm special. It's just like, I want to do good work, but it's hard for me in this specific way.
My impression just visiting with you, Brian, is this is not you didn't need a bigger box because it was an obedience issue. You didn't need a bigger box because you had less motivation. You need a bigger box just of who you are.
Yeah.
And he recognized that you needed a bigger box to be able to be the missionary God wanted you to be. And it wasn't in a way of putting limits on you, but more of an ability to help you reach your potential as a missionary.
Yeah.
I love your mission president. I know you do too, but yeah. I love the sort of the framework that he's been able to adopt to take the great man that you are and sort of put his hands behind you and say, fly.
Yeah.
And you need to fly in a different way perhaps, but you're probably going to reach people in a different way too.
Mm-hmm.
Talk more about your mission.
Well, after the first couple months, when I kind of got my feet under me, I started feeling really confident about being a missionary. And what was really interesting to me is that I kind of assumed that this was going to be me coming and me not being as productive or as successful as other missionaries. But I found that to be exactly opposite. I think that what ended up happening is my experience through this gave me the tools to reach out to people who felt lost. And I started seeing a lot of success. And I don't like to define success as a missionary based on numbers. I don't like to define it based on attitude. I just started feeling like I was connecting with people who felt lost on my mission. And that started to become apparent to my leaders. And it started becoming apparent to the mission president that I was having success. And what was really gratifying is he brought me in and told me that what he wanted to start doing is trying to intercept more missionaries as they were being sent home before they got back to Utah. And he was specifically focusing on Utah missionaries. And at first it was members of my stake, a couple of other missionaries have been sent home from my stake. And he wanted to get them to our mission, and he called them, again, bigger box missionaries, that we were going to give these missionaries some bigger box. So at first it was just a couple. By the end of my mission, I think he had upwards of a dozen missionaries. Wow. And the mission saw tremendous success at that time. And I know that he probably would just say, you know, yeah, it was just the right time in that part of the world for us to have success. But I see a direct relationship between someone who's willing to put their neck on the line in order for these people who kind of their worlds have been destroyed, for someone to believe in them again. I think it's really easy to work hard for someone like that. And I think any one of these other early return missionaries who got put into our mission would say the same thing, which is the minute that you had that confidence. And it was very similar to what my dad told me of, like, you're going to be successful, and whatever form that takes, you're going to have success. And so our mission, by the end of my mission, we had seen like a double, or I think we're almost to a triple, in terms of key indicators. And again, I don't think that defines success necessarily, but I do think there's a straight line between the kind of work, the kind of outreach you can do with an investigator when you yourself had confidence and someone believed in you. That was spilling over into the work. So, wow.
If you had been called to Lubbock from the beginning and had gone to the MTC and had, I don't know what the right word's, a normal experience, and had gone to Lubbock, and versus what happened on how you got to Lubbock, what made you a better missionary under this second longer route to get to Lubbock? I assume you reached people you couldn't have reached.
Yeah, I mean, the metaphor
I assume you helped other missionaries.
Yeah, the metaphor that really started making a lot of sense to me from the scriptures is that leaving the 99 to save the one. And to me, that's how I felt I had been administered to. And that was what I wanted to do for others. I don't think I would have arrived at that conclusion if I had gone out straight from high school with this idea that if I just follow the rules and be righteous, I'll be blessed. And I don't know that that's how life works at all. At least for me, I can't say for others, but at least for me, it's more about trying to identify those who need help and just paying it forward, because that's what was done to me. I don't think I would have arrived at that kind of approach to missionary work. I think I would have been much more involved in numbers success. And I think I would have been a lot more involved in what a lot of people call, you know, exact obedience. I was much more about that those things are not important, and it's important to respect those who do want to do it that way. But for me, it was, I want to identify people who need my help and then help them in any way I can, whether that's bringing them the gospel. But a lot of times what I found is I just wanted to serve them. I didn't even want to even start teaching until they understood that I cared about them.
Wow.
And so, and when someone joins the church because they feel loved, it makes a big difference. And one of the reasons I think we want to integrate people into wards once they're baptized is that belief that someone will be there for you and that believes in you is just as much of a part of your conversion as the belief in what our doctrine is. It's that feeling of that the Spirit cannot help but be present when you're doing service, when you're helping someone else in the best way that you can.
Tell our listeners how you feel like once you, you know, got to Texas and had this good experience, that your relationship was, how it affected your relationship with God and Christ versus just going to Lubbock straight from the beginning with none of these challenges. I assume this, you know, brought you even closer to God and Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in some ways my relationship with my Heavenly Father and with my elder brother Christ is a little bit more informal than I would have expected it to be after my mission, which, I mean, especially with my experience of praying to go on a mission, it started feeling like, oh, God's aware of me. And he kind of just wants to let me lighten up and to be more forgiving of myself, which is somewhat self-serving. But then also, I think what's important of that is being more forgiving of others. And what it really started teaching me is that those is on the fringe of our church, they're the kinds of people that need support, not in any way to try to make their testimony better, but in the ways that they just need that, like, kind of what my dad told me about love without outcome, that all they need to hear is that someone believes that you're going to be you're going to be okay, and that they love you. So I guess my relationship with my Heavenly Father, I think, is defined in a lot of ways by that time, where I started realizing that my life is going to be hard. And no matter what I do, that's not going to change. And, but that my Heavenly Father has confidence in my ability to be successful, even when I stumble. So that I really learned a kind of a macro lesson there, as opposed to just the micro lesson of getting back on the mission, but a macro lesson that, like, life's not going to go according to plan, in any way. And that when you get knocked down, the only thing that can define you is how you get back up. But then also, once you're back on your feet, President Nuchdorf says, that you lift where you stand, and then you pay that back to whoever helped you, and on and on.
Talk about fringes. One of the things we talked about for the podcast is how you feel you're much more connected with those on the margins of the church or on the fringes. And that's because you've been in that space, mm-hmm. As an early release missionary. Talk more about that.
Well, I think the last 6 months of my mission, I was in the mission office. And what basically me and my mission president talked about is that I could kind of go around to the different missionaries, and especially that we'd had a lot of return release missionaries come in, but also just any of the other missionaries that were struggling, and that my companion would go on splits with their companion, and I would just spend some time trying to show them, hey, we can be a bigger box here, and you can give yourself a break and realize that it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, that just find a pace that you're comfortable with. And what that showed me is that when you show belief in someone's struggle, you validate. I think you talk a lot about that word validation. When you validate that someone's struggling and you go, yeah, I was there too. I recognize the way I felt is similar to how you felt, but then not being prescriptive, not saying, and here's what you should do, but to say, you know what, just give yourself a little bit of time to figure it out and realize that you have the mission president's support, my support, and our Heavenly Father's support. And then when I got home from my mission, I started recognizing a lot of other groups that probably felt that way. I think the one that had already been in my head that has still kind of stuck with me is the LGBT community, that it must be really hard for them to know where they fit. It's hard for them, even some of the over-sympathy that I hear on your podcast, a lot of people being overly sympathetic, still making them feel less than, mm-hmm. as opposed to that same idea of, like, we love you. You should be here. It's not really going to, this thing that you're going through is not necessarily a struggle. It's just who you are, and you still belong. And then realizing even when I've seen a lot of my friends who are still in the young single adult wards, that's how a lot of them feel, that they don't feel like there's a place for them in the church, that somehow they are deficient because they're not married. And realizing, and then I guess after a couple of those experiences of seeing groups kind of on the margins, realizing that a lot of people feel that way at some point in their life. And so the best service that I can do and one of the reasons I love that we've changed to ministering is just try to, like, reach out to them and show them support and love, regardless of their testimony or where they are in the church. And sometimes that's really challenging, because a lot of times margins of the groups, at least when I came home from my mission, were, you know, LGBT, people who were doubting, had problems with belief in God. But now I realize in the past couple of years that there are people on the other end that feel like the church is progressing too much, that feel that some of the things the church is doing are not matched up with their values, that they're a little too progressive, and realizing they feel the same way. We have to reach out to them just as much as we reach out to those who tend to believe the same way we do.
That's very empathetic. So, very thoughtful. excuse me. I'm thinking of this bigger box concept, and I'm thinking of parents that may need to have bigger boxes for some of their kids. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of church leaders or an elders quorum president, a release society president that may need to have a bigger box for someone they have stewardship. It's a very interesting concept.
Yeah.
Any more thoughts on that, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the themes of the last couple of years from the Brethren, at least, is this idea that there's not really a prescriptive path to follow. I think with the emphasis on Sabbath day observance, for instance, it's not, these are the things you don't do. And these are the, I mean, they're explicitly saying there's no do or do not list. It needs to be by the Spirit. Even the way we're teaching our youth, and now even in Elders and Relief Society, the Come Follow Me idea, which is don't just read. Try to explore. Try to get the feeling of what you're supposed to say. I think that what my mission president showed me is that he could effectively try to run his mission and administer to his missionaries by not trying to get every person in the mission, every missionary, to be the same, to realizing, well, these people struggle with this, these people struggle with this, and each of them have strengths and each of them need a break on either or. I think, you know, in my callings, a lot of my callings since then have been with the youth. And I think that it fits a lot there. It's like, you know, every youth is different. And what they're struggling with, we need to honor. But also letting it be okay that they're different, that not everyone is the same. And not everyone has to be the same. Not everyone has to have the same kind of testimony. Not everyone has to have the same kind of attitude about the church. So I think, especially with parents who there's so much love for their kids, and a lot of that prescriptive advice comes out of love. But what the best thing you can do for someone who's struggling with things in the church is just try to tell them, like, you're going to be okay. You know, like, let's not be too harsh. This is not a gospel for perfect people. It's a gospel for imperfect people. And part of the covenants of our gospel is just to try to help you get through that imperfection. So as I take the sacrament, I think, how can I, first of all, be okay with who I am, but then how can I try to help others who are having a hard time? So I think, you know, as I'm preparing to become a parent, I hope that I can just try to honor my children's struggles while not trying to make them feel boxed in, to give them a little bit of a bigger box. Because I think it pays dividends when it comes to testimony later, that they realize they come to a realization of what's important to them through experience, sometimes through sad experience, you know. And if our church history shows anything, that sometimes sad experience can be some of the best teaching methods of what the gospel means, because you have to live through it. You have to experience it to understand it. You can't really give it to others. And this is actually something that I've struggled with since being home, is a lot of times people saw my story, heard my story, very happy to hear my story. And they'll have someone in their life who comes home from mission. And what they'll reach out to me is, hey, will you come talk to this person? And it can be really hard to try to tell them, like, I will, but it's not going to be, here's what you should do. You should go on a service mission to Palmyra, and then maybe someone will call you, or get back out. It was the most important thing for me to get back out, so it's the most important thing for you. But honestly, what I usually end up doing when I talk to them is going, you just have to get to a point where you are comfortable making the decision, and then having confidence that is the right decision for you. And then also understanding that not everyone will understand that. And getting comfortable with either going back out or staying home or finding alternative ways to serve. To me, that was the harder part of the last couple of years of my life, is wanting to figure out how I can best tell people who struggle with this issue how they should go forward, which is all I can do is share my experience and hope that they hear the part of it this is what was right for me, but you're just going to have to come to the solution of what's right for you.
I like that. So I want to talk a little bit more about that. Let's just do that a little bit deeper. So let's say right now you've got listeners that have come home from their mission, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, and our culture kind of wants to get them back out. Mm-hmm. And you've got a chance to have a one-on-one visit with them. Tell us more. Just say kind of that, what you've said before.
Well, first of all, I think whatever the reason that you're home from a mission doesn't invalidate your membership in this church. And that in the meantime, as you try to figure out what you are going to do next, try to not let this experience ruin your feeling of belonging in the church, your membership in the church. And there are forces that I don't think are explicit. I don't think anyone's trying to push these people out, but there are forces that will push at you. And it's hard to remain strong in a time where you're that vulnerable. Secondly, it's what do you need to do to make sure that you can successfully get back out on a mission? And if that's realistic, and you want to do that, then go for it. And don't let anyone try to stop what you want to do there. If you feel like you can't do it, or if you think that it's going to get worse because you go out, start being comfortable with not going back out. And I don't say that everyone should necessarily know what that is right away. It took me a long time to figure out what I wanted to do. And even as I had made those decisions, sometimes I was pretty unsure that I made the right decision. Sometimes, I mean, there was a couple times on my service mission where, you know, we'd be re-roofing the Joseph Smith home and tourists are coming by and they would come up to us and they would talk to us. And what I would realize is they thought that I was special needs. And that was, I was like, I don't think that this is healthy for me. I don't know if I feel valid. And then realizing, you know what, that's not something I can base my testimony off of. That's just something I'm struggling through. And then when I went back out to Texas, I was like, I can't believe I decided to come back to this, to that lack of autonomy. But then getting through that was important to me. So if when I talk to them, to people who have come home, I usually just try to say, you know, what do you want to do? And not what people tell you what you want, but figuring out really what you want to do. And secondly, how are you going to navigate the difficulty with either decision? Because going back out will not be easy. I don't know of a lot of missionaries that go back out and just it's fine once they get back out, unless it's something like a broken leg but even people who come back for something, you know, extremely just physical, it's still really hard to come home and go back out. And I've talked to missionaries like that feel like they wasted time here, that they were not honoring their calling because they were sent home. And really also allowing yourself to take a deep breath, that it's not a race. It's not like you spending time at home is hurting your potential future opportunities. And in the throes of youth, it's hard to see that. But from someone that had to go through it, my whole mission experience ended up taking me about 3 years. And so that's a year more than I had expected. But that I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. That was important for me to go through every step of that.
I love that you're a youth leader and you'll just be able to help so many. If there were missionaries that had come home for belated confession, in other words, they messed up and they didn't take care of it and they got in the mission field and realized they need to talk about this and it required them to come home, would you say anything different to that group, Brian, than someone who came home for other reasons like medical?
Probably not, because a lot of times at BYU, I think that was the assumption for me. It was like, oh, he came. Because at that time in the church, mental illness wasn't being discussed as much.
So everybody that came home because they messed up.
It's got to be that.
Take care of
and
it.
At first I was like, it was something I was really proud of to say, no, not that. And then later I'm kind of horrified that I acted proud. Because I was like, there's no, coming home from a mission shouldn't be more valid for a broken leg, more valid for anxiety, more valid for a belated confession. In fact, I find that the belated confession crowd has a lot of integrity, you know, because they get to a point where they're like, hey, I actually don't feel good. I have further light and knowledge to know that I don't feel good about what happened before and I need to take care of that. I have a lot of respect for that. So I would actually tell them the same thing. The harder part there is that they're going to have a hard time separating them coming home with righteousness. And I think there's a stigma, just as much of a stigma with belated confession missionaries as there are mental illness, of like, oh, they were liars. They were, you know, they condemned themselves, when really repentance in any form should be honored and celebrated. And that the same kind of decision, tree goes there of, what do you want to do? Is this something that you feel like you don't want to serve a missionary anymore? I've not met a lot of belated confession missionaries that wanted to stay home. Most of them want to get back out, or else why would they have said anything? So I think, especially wards and parents, it probably shouldn't be as much of a discussion as of why. A lot of times when you hear someone comes home, you'll say, well, why? And it's like, well, it shouldn't really matter, because no matter what it is, it's some sort of health issue with their spiritual health, their emotional health, or their physical health. They're trying to get whole. And that's what we as a church are supposed to help them do. So I don't think there's a lot of difference. I don't see a lot of difference between me and someone who had a belated confession. They had stuff that they needed to figure out in order to be the best missionary that they can be.
Well, now you put some tears in my eyes with what you've just said for a belated confession missionaries. And that you tried to de-shame them by saying further light knowledge versus calling them liars.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Christ would do. And he would put his arms around our belated confession missionaries and not want them to feel any shame.
Mm-hmm.
Shame is I am bad versus I did something bad. And you just de-shamed a lot of belated confession missionaries with the way you lifted them. And that put tears in my eyes because that's a really tough road. And your love for them and your honesty about kind of at first separating yourself from them when you came back and then not separating yourself from them and looking at us as all of God's children trying to move forward in our lives and we need each other. That was really very, very thoughtful. And I think of you as a future father, Brian, and a future youth leader and a future church leader in your ability then to help people. Christ never shamed anybody. He wanted to bring hope to everybody, no matter what had happened to them. I love the prodigal son, where that young man is, he did everything, and Christ never shamed him. He set it up so the father ran to him. Mm-hmm. He didn't make him grovel. He didn't have him come home at night so he could be in his bed. He ran towards him and kissed him and put a ring on his finger and a coat to signify sonship. So I think we have to take the same approach with everybody as they want to come back. Talk, if you had parents, we're in a round table in my front room, listeners, so I sometimes imagine all of you here. And if you have parents that are listening to this podcast that have a son or a daughter that's come home, what would you say to them?
I don't want to be too prescriptive, but the thing that made the difference for me was this kind of general acceptance of we trust you. And I think, you know, in some ways it's kind of a crossroads of a time of life. You know, they've just graduated from high school. Sometimes, you know, they've had a year of college, sometimes they haven't, but this is such a pivotal moment in their lives. And if it becomes a negative moment, I think it can do a lot of damage. Whether it's a negative moment or not, doesn't really fall on anyone but the person themselves. But there's lots you can do to make sure that they navigate it with the best tools at their disposal. So I think trying to be in tune with the Spirit without being overly preach-oriented, that a lot of times, especially missionaries who want to serve missions, that I don't think that they have a lack of understanding of the gospel, but more are trying to work through a really difficult situation. So, you know, I guess the model, and this is going to kind of sound a little corny, but the model would be listen to them, learn what from other people that have gone through it. Because now I think what the church has done with a lot of things, like they have this new workbook that it's like dealing with missionary life, or I can't remember the exact title, but and it tells them how to kind of work through this. There's a lot more resources when it comes to counseling and psychiatry, and a lot less of a stigma of using those resources. That there's lots of tools that they can use to try to be whole. But then also realizing that missions, while very important and in many ways beautiful, they're not a covenant. They're not something that are necessary for us to become celestial beings, right? And so what's more important is to focusing on honoring your covenants. And for me, that the service mission was me trying to honor my baptismal covenant of mourning with those that mourn and you know, being willing to, and my temple covenant of being willing to consecrate my efforts. And as I started focusing on covenants as opposed to checklist, oh, I need to be a return missionary, I felt like I got more joy. And so if there's anything that parents can do, it's try to make the missionary feel more comfortable with who they are, even if that means they stay home and they don't go back out. Because the real goal is to try to keep them members of our church, not because we want them to be good people, but because we realize that membership in the church will benefit them. Their covenants will bring blessings. And I see a lot of blessings for my mission, but I had to get to a point where I was like, if I don't go back out on a mission, I'll still be a productive, normal human being.
What a great place to be in.
So.
Talk about dating. At some point, you needed to tell your now wife why you were dating, your mission experience. Were you fearful that would be hard for her and she might not wanted to date you anymore. And how did she navigate that? And
yeah, I think she had been around our family a lot. So she knew at the time when I had come home, we weren't together at that point and hadn't dated yet. But she knew the struggle that it was. And it was pretty easy for me after I got home to be very confident in what I had accomplished. Not necessarily that it was some awesome thing, but I was very proud that I had ended up actually finishing what I had set out to do. So the confidence of people believing in me, and especially having a mission president who believed in me, my parents who believed in me when I got home, it was never a secret.
Good.
And one of the things that I really try to tell people that come home is you got to get to a point where it's not something that you feel ashamed of. If you feel shame about it, you've either got to figure out why you're feeling shame and address that, or you really do want to go back out. It's something you want for yourself. And a lot of times I'll tell them there are a lot of service opportunities that aren't, you know, a proselyting mission, and that give you that confidence that you consecrated your efforts for others. So when we talked a lot about it, I think that it was really important to me that whoever I ended up with understood how important that kind of unique journey of mine was. But then me and my wife for the past couple of years have struggled with infertility. Mm-hmm. And I feel prepared by this experience and my mission to be able to navigate that. And I think that a lot of the skills I learned as a early return missionary helped me not feel depressed and trusting that no matter what happens, we're going to figure it out, and giving ourselves a little bit of a bigger box. And I think my wife has appreciated that and has kind of, most of my callings with the youth, she's also, you know, she's a teacher with the youth. So I think that we're very much on the same page there. So in many ways, it wasn't really an issue. In fact, I think it's a source of strength for us. Both trials now, the infertility and the coming home early, really give us a lot of confidence in our testimonies and what we believe is important.
It's interesting about the infertility and you linking your ability to navigate that road because of the road you've navigated.
Mm-hmm.
And the principles that you've learned and the sort of creating self-worth around you and not around a specific outcome. It comes back to what your father said, that so, you know, powerful,
mm-hmm.
and so doable. What a thoughtful thing that he said. We're kind of coming to the end, Brian. Are there any other things you would like to share?
The only other thing that I think maybe needs to be more talked about, at least, is just this idea that as mission presidents, I can't think of a role in my life that has been more influential as my mission president, except for maybe my parents. That you hold a lot of these young men and young women's lives. It's not like you're responsible for our lives, but actions that you take to help your missionaries affect these people's lives forever. And I don't necessarily want to say that people, you know, mission presidents who send people home have, you know, responsibility in hurting people's lives. But I do think that if we could make an extra effort to try to make sure that these young men and young women feel supported and loved and have a pathway in our church, that it makes all the difference. It did in my life. I know all of the other early return missionaries in the Lubbock, Texas mission. At that time, it made, and I still keep in contact with a lot of them, it made all the difference to them. And I can't tell you how much love and appreciation I have for my mission president, what he did for me. And I just hope, and I know that as mission presidents are trying to be in tune with the Spirit, that they will do what's in the best interests of their missionaries. We just need to try to be supportive and understanding of mission presidents that are trying to keep kids on missions for the right reasons, and also keeping kids healthy and emotionally, spiritually, and physically. You know, my plea to mission presidents is just trying to listen to the missionaries who are having problems, learning what the best out of the box solutions can be, and then loving them no matter what the outcome is. So
I love that. I love this idea of giving people bigger boxes. I think of that from a parenting perspective right now, and what I can do as a parent. You know, using the analogy is I'm a mission president and my wife and I are mission presidents over the six kids and two grandkids. And what can we do, or what bigger box can I do in a church calling?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking back to my YSA assignment. What, you know, did I do that at times? And did I feel permission to create a bigger box at times? And I hope it seems like Christ, you know, I'm trying to think of, it seems like he was always trying to create space. I think of the visual of the table that Christ invited everybody to be at. And sometimes I see a visual on social media that Christ just kept making the table bigger and bigger so more people would have a seat there. And in a way, that's to your point, Brian, of, you know, making a bigger box and making more room for people. And as we're all trying to do our best to move forward, and I think a lot of leaders probably need to feel permission to create bigger boxes. I've followed all the rules and procedures, but a couple times I did some things, I probably practiced the principle of exception. Mm-hmm. And I think you can, that's a true principle in our church, and I think you can practice the principle of exception that Elder Packer talked about if you're a rule follower. Mm-hmm. And if then you have maybe the perspective to know when it's time to do an exception. And I don't, and maybe you coming directly to Lubbock from Palmyra is the principle of an exception that's part of our gospel doctrine. I remember when our own stake president was called in our stake, the general authority as he was leaving, my stake president told me this story. He says, don't forget the principle of exception. And there are times when you need to be close enough to the Spirit and feel confident enough you're close to the Spirit to allow an exception. I don't know. So those are things that aren't going to be listed in our handbook anywhere, but mm-hmm. I think it is a principle that's consistent with our gospel that priesthood leaders need to feel permission to do at times.
Yeah.
And because there will be exceptions to the administrative policies or, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, obedience exceptions where someone goes to the temple unworthy, but I think some of the things that you've illustrated in your journey help us understand this, and the visual of creating a bigger box to me is a perfect application of this principle. Mm-hmm. And then I look at you and where you are now because people created a bigger box for you and your wonderful testimony and all the people you reached in Texas and the youth you're reaching. I just, you know, I think of the youth in my own ward and stuff, and I realize that some of them need a bigger box. Mm-hmm. To be able to feel like they belong. I do love this idea of fitting in is sort of becoming something we're not to be accepted. Mm-hmm. And belonging is being able to be accepted for who we are. And we don't have to become something we're not to be able to fit in, and belonging is sustainable and fitting in may not be.
Yeah.
So you belong, obviously, in our church, and you belonged in your mission. Mm-hmm. And part of that was the bigger box that your mission president created. So you had a feeling of belonging, and you didn't have to fit into the smaller box that may have been not sustainable for you.
Yeah.
And may have caused you to leave Texas or possibly even leave our church. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't enough space for you to belong the way you are. And that's certainly true with our LGBTQ friends who need to belong based on their sexual orientation, who they really are inside versus the need to fit in to something they may not be.
Exactly.
So, great podcast. Any other comments, Brian, you'd like to share with our listeners that come to mind?
I mean, I just want to maybe turn the table and just tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing here. Coming from a place of faith to talk about how we can better ourselves as members of the church to help other people feel belonging has made a big difference in my life. It's actually made a really big difference in my parents' lives. And I think the conversations you have coming from a place of faith are incredibly helpful. And I hope that more and more people who listen to this podcast will recommend it to people in their lives. And I know you don't obviously want to have this be a platform or a following or anything but a conversation. And I really appreciate that. I think that's a unique part of what you're doing. But I just hope more and more people can hear these kinds of conversations and realize that there's nothing antagonistic about trying to have better conversations in our church. So I really appreciate what you're doing, Brother Osler.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love.